You cannot lose games in the NFL and still win.
One day, I understand. One day, go see the baby be born and come back. You're a Major League Baseball player.
Did I not tell you?
Yes, you did.
See, don't answer. These are rhetorical questions because you know I told you and you know I'm
not. Analytics don't work at all. They're just a crap to some people who were really smart, made up, and tried to get in the game because they had no talent.
This kid is a gamer. He's a baller. He's a playmaker and a shot caller.
In case you didn't know,
I got T-Bowed. He shattered the mold. And all he does is win. All he does is win.
Hello and welcome to Hot Takedown, 538's podcast about the week in sports narratives. I'm Chadwick Matlin, an editor at 538, and with me in the studio all together again is the crew, Kate Fagan,
back
ESPNW
together.
Columnist. Hi, Kate.
Hi, Chad.
And Neil Payne.
Reunited and it feels so good.
Or the voice that may or may not be Neil Payne. Neil, you still got a little croak in there.
Yeah, just the voice is the last thing to come back, I feel like.
Okay, guys, can I confess something to you?
Yes.
I issued a hot take in the last week since we've all been together.
This is a good confessional space for that.
No one's listening, right? We're safe here.
That's right.
So the Mets closer had a kid, Mazel Tov, to Jay Reese Familia.
Congrats.
Just as Danny Murphy had a kid in the theme song that we hear every week with Mike Francesa saying, have the kid or have the baby be born, see the kid and come back.
One day.
Yeah. So Familia, because he was tending to his familia, and this was my very pained joke, couldn't pitch.
God.
And the Mets blew the game. And I tweeted about it. I'm
you did
embarrassed
the familia thing, too?
Yeah, I don't want to talk about it. I mean, I obviously had to tell you, but I really don't want to belabor the point.
Okay, I'm not even going to look for that tweet.
Please don't. Okay, so
you have to. Your penance is going to have to be to read 5 baseball prospectus stories.
That's sort of my job.
Week.
But yes,
are those like Hail Marys? Or
that's
something?
Right.
Okay, so let's move on from my shame. Today on the show, the Stanley Cup has a new home, and it's one it's been to before. We'll talk Chicago's 3rd championship in 6 years, and then we will make sense of the breaking news out of baseball, where the FBI is investigating the St. Louis Cardinals for hacking into the Houston Astros computer system and stealing all sorts of proprietary data about the players in the league. And then we'll discuss LeBron James' Sisyphean struggle to bring the Cavs to the mountaintop. And then, of course, Allison McCann will be here, talk a little Women's World Cup in our SIG dig. But guys, on Monday night, the Blackhawks overcame tornado warnings and the lightning to once again hoist the Stanley Cup.
I see what you did there.
Thank
really
you.
Really clever.
Can we also pause just to talk about why the Stanley Cup is hoisted and not lifted, right?
It's pretty heavy.
It's heavy.
You kind of get some momentum to get it up there.
Yeah. Earlier I was talking to Jody, our producer, and he said two-hand lifting is hoisting.
Mm.
But you hoist a flag, and that's sort of up a pole. Anyway.
But you use two hands.
That's true. Good point. So, okay, let's back to the Blackhawks, who are no stranger to the Cup. Here's how Commissioner Gary Bettman put it when he presented the team the trophy after the game.
Well, Chicago, that's 3 cups in 6 seasons. I'd say you have a dynasty.
He used the D word. Do we think Bettman is right? A guy who NHL fans don't think is right about much. Are the Blackhawks a dynasty?
That was an oddly receptive crowd.
They booed him beforehand. They booed him beforehand.
Less than usual, I feel like. I think our chief hockey writer, Nate Silver, made a great point yesterday when he talked about in hockey, it seems to be, especially going back to about the 90s when the NHL went crazy with its expansion and added, 10 new teams in the span of just a handful of years?
The Lightning, one of them.
The Lightning were one of those teams, the Blackhawks not. They were an original 6 team. That it's become so much harder to string together even, like, I don't know, if you're a dynasty elitist, maybe you think you have to win consecutive titles at least to be in that discussion. But I think winning them every other year, like the Blackhawks have done the past couple of years, and then 3 and 6 in a salary capped league, in a league that has 30 teams, and in a sport like hockey, which and Kate, we can talk about this, seems to have more luck involved than any of the other big 3 North American pro sports. It seems like quite an accomplishment, worthy of a dynasty appellation. It seems.
It's definitely an accomplishment. Maybe I'm a stickler for the actual word dynasty and its origins and what it actually means and like consecutive rule. And
are we going back to the Ming dynasty?
Yes, or many of those dynasties. There was not a break in that rule. That was just consecutive.
The House of York.
Like we could get Game of Thrones on
this.
That's
right. Too. Yeah.
I just feel that we're overusing that word a little bit lately. In sports, of course, about, okay, well, if a team wins back-to-back, not just in hockey, but in any sport, they're like, oh, they're a dynasty. I like to think that maybe we want to reserve it for franchises and teams that win in a way that we very rarely see. Because if you look even at the NHL, what are we going to say if the Kings win next year? They're going to have 1-3 of 6.
We've got two alternating dynasties.
Two teams dominating in their dynasties at the same time. How are we going to even get to that space?
I guess that's just an aristocracy, right? It's just two rulers.
Yeah, an oligopoly.
Yeah.
So I like to reserve that for our true dynasties.
So as Neil mentioned, Nate Silver wrote something about the declining chances the dynasty could happen in all the sports except for the NBA, interestingly, which saw a rise in the 90s and the early 2000s. Are you not swayed by the idea that the way we talk about sports should be relative to what's possible in sports in the time span that it's happening? And so in this case, the salary cap era after the strike maybe changes what's possible in mm-hmm. hockey. And so we need to still talk. We need to essentially adapt our grading relative to what's happening now. And I do some rock climbing, and when you climb old rock climbing routes, they're graded really as though they're easy. So should we think about accomplishment relative to the time that it's happening in?
Right. So it's kind of like, are we grading these teams on a curve because of how much more difficult the data shows that hockey... I totally buy into that what the Chicago Blackhawks have done is really impressive given the current state of the NHL. I think it might just be a question of, do we want to save that term dynasty for franchises that have done things that we very rarely see in sports, as opposed to very casually tossing around that term? Because I do get how the randomness of hockey, as well as the salary cap, and as well as Nate's data showing how much harder it is to have a franchise to not just repeat, but even win in multiple championships in a small time frame. I just don't think dynasty, especially when you think of the Kings example, like how if they win next year.
So you think there can only be one dynasty at once is your point, because it has to be uninterrupted.
And sometimes there aren't any dynasties. Mm-hmm. That's what I think. I mean, there are lots of sports right now where like we don't have a dynasty. In fact, what? Is there a sport right now where I would label a dynasty?
I feel like you heard about the Spurs dynasty in the last few years.
And that's a really good kind of litmus test for this, because the Spurs never won back-to-back championships. And in fact, if you stretch it back to 1999 when they won their first under Tim Duncan, you could say, well, a dynasty happened in the midst of that with the Lakers. In fact, you could almost argue two Laker dynasties if you want to count the one with Kobe and Pau Gasol later in the 2000s happened bookended, you know, with Spurs championships around it. And yet we do seem to treat that Spurs run as perhaps not a continuous dynasty in the sense that you think that they were, you know, just blowing the doors off everyone every single year within, but we give them that dynasty credit, it seems like. So maybe there's they get like special dispensation maybe because mm-hmm. it lasted so long between championships and they won, you know, more than you would think you would expect a team that even, you know, maybe you have to win three to qualify for a dynasty and they've exceeded that. Mm-hmm. So maybe they get credit for that.
And maybe it just is a matter of us in sports only having that one word to define franchises.
That's what I was saying. Maybe we need, it needs to be a word.
Crowdsource a secondary tag on a franchise that has done something over a period of time. I mean, I'm not saying we actually need to do this, but it could be good to have another word that we're defining some of these things by so that we can reserve dynasty for really exclusive examples.
You're the protector of the dynasty label. I like
that.
And
I didn't even know I was going to do that. It's just the emotion just came up in me, and I was like, I need to.
You're Bettman.
So, dynasty purist.
That's right.
So let's talk about the Blackhawks themselves and how they made this run. What word should I use right now, Kate? This
very impressive hockey over the course of these last few years.
This very impressive hockey accomplishment hockey over a set time span. So, Neil, mm-hmm. this is the part of the show where we talk about Corsi. I think we've mentioned that word at least once on this show before. The Blackhawks have good Corsi. Is that the right wording to put to it? High Corsi.
Their Corsi was exemplary.
Excellent. And so tell the listeners, for those who are unaware, and perhaps the panelists who are unaware, what Corsi is and why it matters so much to the Blackhawks strategy.
So Corsi is the percentage of on-ice shots directed at the net. So they don't actually even have to, you know, be stopped by the goalie or go into the back of the net. They just have to be directed in the vicinity of the net.
Is there a clear delineation about what the vicinity is?
Well, some of that is up to the scorekeeper the discretion of the scorekeeper, and certainly different arenas have different scorekeepers that have more or less liberal definitions of what constitutes a shot attempt. And then there's also, we can get into Fenwick, which is a variant of Corsi that I believe doesn't include block shots. One of them does and one of them doesn't, and even I can't always keep track of which is which. But that's kind of getting lost in the forest, in the trees and missing the forest. The main thing is that Corsi is a proxy for puck possession, because the other team can't direct a shot at your net if they don't have the puck. So it sort of measures how much you control the puck and how much you're sort of tilting the ice toward your opponent's goal and away from your own.
So in this instance, the Blackhawks are really good at controlling possession of the puck, and as a result are able to control basically how random the play becomes, because if you're holding the puck, the randomness, in this case from the Lightning or from their other opponents this season and through the playoffs, that the puck can't skip off the ice in a weird way or hit someone's skate and deflect into the goal when perhaps Corey Crawford isn't looking.
Right. There's a lot of evidence and research going back the past couple of years that says basically what happens after you shoot is sort of random. If we think about in baseball terms, it's sort of like after a pitcher allows a ball in play, there's not a whole lot of control over whether it falls in for a hit or not. That's a BABIP. Yeah, exactly. That's kind of the same idea for hockey, where if you look at goalies' correlation of save percentage from year to year, or you know, even across like multiple years, the same goalies will tend to regress very heavily back toward the overall average of the league. And the same thing with shooters. There are only a handful of shooters that have like a persistent ability to score as a percentage of their shots more than the league average. So the Blackhawks seem to be one of these teams that were early adopters, and they bought into the idea of puck possession as the key to winning in hockey, and they went out and they got a bunch of guys that emphasized that aspect of the game, and that seems to be sort of the driving force behind this dynasty. Is they took a team and they built this team that has ranked in the top, you know, five or even higher in Corsi for each of the past, you know, five or more years.
Well, first of all, we did not confirm that we thought they were a dynasty, and I saw that you slipped that word
did
in.
Did I slip it in?
But, I mean, a few weeks ago we talked about the Rangers when they were still in the midst of their playoff run, and how apparently they weren't very high on this Corsi ranking. Does this boil down to as simple as like a clash of styles, like you might see on the soccer field, where you'll have Spain that's possession-oriented versus any nation that will play more of a direct style? Or does this play out differently in hockey?
Like, no, I think that's a really good comparison. I think that it really is like a battle for the soul of hockey in some ways. And we've, especially when people first came out with this research, there was a lot of debate over whether the stat heads were just missing, you know, how can it be that, you know, there's no variation between teams in their persistent ability to score on their shots or stop shots? And how can it be luck that you know causes these huge distinguishing characteristics of teams? And so you heard a lot of debate about that, but there have been a lot of cases where teams survived based on shooting percentage and save percentage and not on Corsi. And in most of those cases we've seen over the past few years, those teams, they would come out and they would look really good. They would have a good record based on that. And the stat heads would say the bottom is going to fall out of this, just you watch. And invariably, it seems that has actually borne out, and those teams have regressed, whereas the teams that depend on Corsi more have seemed to have more staying power.
And interestingly, that also changes the way, perhaps, that they need to rely on their goaltender because of the way they possess the puck. One thing, Kate, and then we need to move on, that your mention of the Rangers reminded me of is I instant messaged Nate earlier today, and I said, our hockey writer Nate, thank you, and I said he had written something that said the Rangers were the Spurs of the NHL, and I said, if the Rangers were the Spurs of the NHL, what does that make the Blackhawks?
Right.
And he said the Spurs, which maybe gets into the dynasty thing. And
every team is the Spurs of hockey.
Right. So before we move on, I should say, listeners, if you do have a better word than dynasty, mm-hmm. or run or mini epic or whatever, what about the epic? It's Blackhawks epic, EPOCH, of course.
Oh, yeah.
Epoch.
That could work.
Now we're using like paleontological terms.
I would love if we could come up with something that's sort of in the vein of a political dynasty, another word for a government that has maintained. Is there a word for a government that has gone out of power and then come back into power?
Ooh, world history PhDs.
Let us know.
Get in touch with us. You can tweet any of us or email contact@538.com. Anyway, let's leave it there for now and get a word from our sponsor. Our sponsor this week is SeatGeek, the smartest way for fans to save money on sports tickets. People of Houston, you have surely read the headlines by now. We are about to talk about them in the next segment. The St. Louis Cardinals have allegedly hacked into your baseball team's databases and stolen all sorts of player evaluation data. You want vengeance. I would want. Would you guys want vengeance if you were Astros fans?
I would. I mean, not like violent vengeance, but I would want to win.
Vengeance.
I would want to win on the baseball field.
Yeah, winning is, living well is the best.
So I went through SeatGeek today and I looked whether the Astros were playing the Cardinals this year. They are not, but vengeance is only 12 and a half hours and an 84 deal score away. Because by the time you hear this, the St. Louis Cardinals' next home game is probably going to be June 26th, depending on when you listen to this podcast. And SeatGeek has a ticket for you to be at that game. It has hundreds of tickets available for that game. And you can save $20 if you buy one using our promo code TAKEDOWN. And better yet, you can make sure while you do it that you're not getting fleeced. SeatGeek has a fancy deal algorithm that takes into account historical deal prices and the magnitude of the event. And for you, Astros fan, the magnitude of this event will be big, will be high. And it'll tell you your ticket's deal score. And so if you use our promo code TAKEDOWN, you'll get a $20 rebate off your first SeatGeek purchase, whether it's the Cardinals game or anything else. That's promo code TAKEDOWN. The SeatGeek app is your ticket to sports and all sorts of vengeance and booing this spring. So just a few hours before we recorded this podcast, the New York Times broke the news that the FBI is investigating the St. Louis Cardinals for quote-unquote hacking, and I use that term loosely, and we'll get into why, into databases that belonged to the Houston Astros in 2013. It's a complicated story that's still developing, so if I could just monologue to you guys the news for a minute. I'm going to run down what we know and what, at least to my knowledge, we don't know.
Can I call it a soliloquy, or does it have to be a monologue?
I think readers should tweet us alternative words,
okay, cool.
And then we'll figure it out. So here's what we know. Jeff Luhnow, and we had to look up how to pronounce his name. We think we got it right. The Astros general manager helped the Cardinals build its strong minor league system until 2011. And in 2011, he left to go rebuild the Astros as their general manager. And once he decamped for Houston, Luhnow built something called Ground Control, which was a database of player evaluations. And it was similar to what the Cardinals had, and their system was called Redbird, and it was apparently protected by the same or at least similar passwords as the ones that Luhnow used while he used this system Redbird
Come
with the Cardinals.
On.
I know.
Smart guys.
Ugh.
Yeah, exactly. Best and the brightest. So last year, Deadspin published excerpts from Ground Control, from a leak that came out of Ground Control, and it detailed 10 months' worth of potential trades that the Astros had discussed, including Giancarlo Stanton for George Springer, which would have been a real blockbuster, and the Astros rejected it. And it's sort of gone into reasons why they rejected it in some cases, but really was just sort of almost like a what-if transaction log of all these things that could have happened. And it showed basically that like GMs are entertaining proposals all the time. You sort of think that as a fan, but we haven't quite had proof like this. And so soon afterward, after that interview, after that leak, Luhnow said in an interview that the FBI was on the case. And now, a year later, the FBI has issued subpoenas to the Cardinals and Major League Baseball. And the Cardinals, until now, have been a sterling example of a franchise that just reloaded talent year after year. And even after Albert Pujols left, they still make the World Series. Just a very
now
good sound. So, well, whoa there, Kate.
That's my allegedly.
Take. And so, all of a sudden, they have their own Deflategate scandal, basically, that's going to become bigger than the Cardinals and be about the whole sport one way or another. So here, that's what we know, I think. Does that make sense? Do we take a breath? We mm-hmm. good?
God, cool. FBI is all over the sports these days.
I know. Maybe the sports bubble, which is what a lot of sports people talk about, which is that there's so much money awash in sports right now, will burst, not because the market will correct for it, but rather the feds will just rain down upon
it.
Okay, so here's what we don't know, I think. We don't know why the Cardinals officials hacked into the Astros system, if they did it. Is it for vengeance because Luno left and at the time left for a divisional rival when the Astros were still in the National League? Or is it because ground control was so cutting edge? And we can get into what we know about ground control, this database system. Was it because the Cardinals used some of this? Do we know if the Cardinals used this information for competitive gain? Are there prospects in the Cardinals system that are there because of ground control? Did they make any trades? Did they, for whatever reason, know the trades to make to prevent the Astros? I don't know. Did they use it in any way? And then what's the punishment for corporate espionage within Major League Baseball or sports in general? Because we're led to believe that this is the first corporate espionage story that we've ever seen in sports. Phew. I think that does it, guys.
Except you started by saying you're not using the word hack.
Right. Okay. So is it hacking? This is not quite sportsy, but is it hacking if you just if you just log in because you know somebody's password? Like if I would never. But if some ex-girlfriend of mine, I just knew her passwords or something, and I hacked in, and I logged into her email, I'm not sure that's hacking. I'm not sure.
Right. It's still an emotional breach.
Very unethical.
Yes.
Yes. I'm not arguing otherwise, guys. Right. I understand what's right.
But hacking does convey this idea that you had some sort of sophisticated system in which to get in.
Right. This is
so
not, this is not Chinese hackers hacking into federal argument. Social security numbers for federal employees. So, lots of questions, and this is very early on, so I think we can basically spitball about sort of what this moment means for the data age in sports, because I think it is a sort of watershed, because to me, after I read this, it was sort of a duh moment where this was inevitable. At some point, someone was going to do this for competitive game.
Well, my first question is, you kept labeling ground control as like this sophisticated database. Like, why for folks of your ilk who might understand this better, why is it so sophisticated? And do you think it's that database is more sophisticated than other Major League Baseball
teams? I only know what I've read in a Bloomberg Businessweek article, and we'll put it on 538.com for readers to read, for listeners and watchers to read, because we're videoing this segment. It had, from what I understand, it had built-in algorithms to show when a player should be promoted or should be sent down to the minors or should be cut and released. And that was all based on numbers. So if someone, I think the example was that someone had their max skill percentile or something like that, it was called, was like 97%. So they would be as good as 97. They would be better than 97% of the players in the league. And right now in the minors, they were performing at 75. They were performing better than 75% of the people in the majors or the minors. I forget. So because that gap had gotten close enough, it suggested that he was ready to be promoted. And that's the kind of algorithmic work that, from what I understand, was cutting edge in the Astros system. That wasn't. Neil, do you know any more than that?
No, I first of all, that Bloomberg article probably found a lot of traffic and new life today in light of this story, because that's sort of all that we know about it was when they kind of opened that little door and let us have a tiny little peek. But we do know that the Astros are one of the most progressive franchises in terms of just sabermetrics. If you think about it, they hired like a bunch of people from Baseball Prospectus to be, you know, in their scouting and their player development ranks. And we talked about Colin McHugh a couple weeks ago and the fact that they apparently used some of the more, you know, granular stats about like ball flight and spin rate
his number of curveball pitch have gone up since being an Astro, and perhaps that's because of what their analytics said about what pitches he should be throwing more.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, I mean, if there were a team that you would want to spy on and you were trying to kind of get insider secrets about what the cutting edge of sabermetrics is, it might be the Astros of all the teams that you could pick from. I'm not sure. You know, you hear about other teams. You know, the Rays bought all in, and our friend Jonah Carey wrote a book about that. Before them was the A's and Billy Bean and Moneyball, of course. But if you think about the latest team to sort of assume that mantle, especially this year, since they have made the leap from being this team that had potential to being a legitimate.
There's
contender.
Real potential for an Astros Cardinals World Series, which would just delight me.
My goodness.
So fun.
The narrative around that would be great.
So, Kay, one of the questions I have is whether this is that different from espionage, analog espionage, if you can call it that. And when you were a player, were there protections around scouting reports and things like that?
That was my first response when reading about all this stuff. Is like, well, how different is this really than what we see over sports in the history? Because I'm assuming 100 years ago, you'd have some scout sneak into some spot to be able to take a look at the players on another team and create their own sort of scouting reports. I think that stuff like this probably has happened, and there's not a ton different to it, except that because of technology, the location of a lot of information is all in one place, which I think changes the game a little bit. Because before, you could probably swipe some data here or there, and by data I just mean maybe a scouting report or a look, or you'd be trying to gain an advantage. But now it feels like the one thing that's a game changer is the amount in one fell swoop that you can gather if you do /know the password.
Yeah, I think it wasn't efficient in the past to do this kind of espionage because all you were doing, you had to physically go to the office and you had to break, like Watergate almost, and you had to break in and you had to steal physical documents. And so there just wasn't any percentage in it to do that. But I think now, and you saw this with business in, you know, the 80s and the 90s as computing became more, you know, widespread and data became a thing, you know, that people actually coveted instead of just being, you know, a series of numbers that were input into a spreadsheet, you started seeing a ton of corporate espionage cases happening to the point that the government had to actually rewrite the rules of what constituted it because there was technology that was facilitating it and it actually became cost efficient for companies to try to do it. So the concern on my mind here is that have we reached this point in baseball? And like you said, Chad, it's almost like in retrospect, now that we know that this has happened apparently in this case, it's like, oh, well, duh, why didn't this happen years ago? Because we have reached this data age in sports where all of this important information is being tracked on computers and on files that potentially could be stolen, like you said, in one swipe, Kate.
Yeah. And I think on a fundamental level, I feel like this additional information or the perspective that the Cardinals, if this did happen, if they did steal this information that they get from the Astros is invaluable. And I guess I lean toward that thought because I know when I was playing college basketball, we would always, when we left an opposing locker room, we would make sure that we had all brought whatever scouting report we had brought with us, we were taking out. So we didn't leave behind a 22-page scouting report for the other team to look at. And there had been times when I played where you would go into the locker room after a game and the opposing team had left a scouting report. And that information was so interesting only because you never, as a player, really got anybody's like true view of you from your coaching staff or your teammates. Like, because they're always worried about, you know, the emotional impact of being honest. And this is a very like anecdotal point of view on this, but reading what somebody else's perspective on us as a team or you as a player when they're not worried about what hurting your feelings or how it might impact the dynamic of a team was eye-opening. And so I can imagine for another team to see how another team is viewing the league and not just entrenched in their own viewpoint is invaluable as well.
So, but we don't know if the players necessarily saw the stolen information, but even then you're saying for the general manager or for the executives or the scouts to know whether or not their own impressions are legitimated by someone else's viewpoint, there is some value there, you're saying?
Because I think when they're at their conferences or meetings and they're kind of all talking about players, like, everybody has their own motivation for what they're sharing. I'm assuming in this database, all of that motivation was stripped away and it was just their thinking on stuff unfiltered by whatever the environment was, which I think would be invaluable for any franchise to see.
So I want to talk about the Cardinals in particular because they've been so good for so long. this hack is a recent one. From my understanding, reading this,
I was totally kidding earlier about this being the justification for why the Cardinals have been so good over the years, too. Because, you know, we don't want hot ticks on here.
So here's, but here's my point. It's only been 2 years since they've had this data from the Astros. Do we think that we need to reevaluate the whole era of the last of the Cardinals for the last decade? That seems extreme to me. However, what a lot of people talked about during Deflategate is if Brady cheated with the footballs being inflated, and we know that Belichick and Spygate, that Belichick had sort of been watching, what was it, the Jets warm-ups? Was that what it was? Or
during
practices?
Spygate? No, it was like the defensive signals from the sideline, but then there were also stories that they had taped St. Louis Rams walkthroughs and various other things that they were not supposed to be privy to.
That's right. So there's a smoke, where there's smoke, there's fire element here. So what do we as fans and as empiricists, what are we supposed to do when we get a hint that someone's maybe bending the rules a bit, especially in this instance where it could just be personal vengeance?
Yeah, that's pretty difficult to say with any kind of accuracy because we know so little about this specific case. And it's worth saying that when Luno was with the team, they were excellent. And they've actually been even better from a record standpoint after he left them.
Using some of the players that he helped them get.
Using some, yeah, it's worth saying that he was involved in the drafting of some of the players that have contributed since then. So it's just entirely too early, I think, to jump to any kind of conclusions about it. And it's tough to say because there have been so few cases of this in just all of sports, even like the Patriots. Maybe you hold them up as an example and you say, well, they were willing to cheat on, you know, Spygate and bend the rules in that case. And then it turned out, you know, many years people were saying, oh, well, maybe that was just an isolated incident. And maybe that was just, you know, they didn't fully accept the ramifications of the memos that went around that said, oh, hey, guys, you can't tape this. And maybe everyone was doing it. And then you get to Deflategate years later, and it does kind of cause you, especially in conjunction with some of the stats that we've seen about what outliers they are with fumbles. And there's a whole other discussion to be had about that. But it does kind of make you, at least from a perspective of, you know, trying to assess the probability that there's some kind of wrongdoing, you have to increase the probability based on like a couple of incidents like that. And even in the case of the Cardinals here, one incident, you know, makes you think that there might be more wrongdoing. But again, we don't really know.
And I think the key piece of info for me will be whether like the leadership in the Cardinals knew about
who knew what when.
Yeah, I mean, because if
how far does this go up?
If it's a couple staffers who kind of went rogue, that's hard to believe if it's proven true that happened, because where are they giving the information once they get it? Like, you know, it kind of has to filter up, and you would think that the top level management would know. Otherwise, how are they even taking the data and doing anything useful with it? But if it is the top level, then you kind of question the leadership of the Cardinals if it gets to that point.
So I think we should leave it there for now. I have a feeling we're going to be talking about this as it unfolds. And listeners and viewers, you can read Neil on this very subject at 538.com, and be sure to let us know what you think. And for those watching on video, you can subscribe to this podcast at iTunes.com/538. And for those listening, on to the next topic. We're talking to you on Tuesday afternoon. And from where we're sitting, the NBA playoffs are not over yet. The Warriors are up 3-2 over the LeBrons after a sizzling Game 5. That Game 5 was so, so good. But from where you're listening, the Warriors may already be the world champions, because you might be listening after Game 6 was played on Tuesday night. Or perhaps David Blatt finally let Timofey Mozgov be the hero that he's always been destined to be.
Free Timofey.
Exactly. Play him in the fourth quarter. Play him in overtime. And maybe we're headed to a Game 7. But this finals has been too good for us to not discuss, even though we're in this weird limbo space. And that's in large part because of LeBron James, who is playing 46 minutes a game after playing – this must be his 100-something game, right?
Must be.
Depending on how many he missed during the regular season. But 46 minutes a game – 37 points a game, making me shake my head in disbelief at least 5 times a game. Jalen Rose thinks that means that LeBron deserves the MVP no matter what happens next.
I think he's ahead of the curve. Nobody felt like the Cleveland Cavaliers would put themselves in position to be in game six, his first year back with the team. So for him to be in this spot is really because he's averaging 40. It's because he's averaging over 10 rebounds and basically averaging 8 or 9 dimes. Like, he will be the first MVP on a losing team of the NBA Finals since Jerry West in the late 60s. That validates it right there.
That's from Jalen and Jacoby from our sister site, Grantland, and their great podcast on the Grantland Network. So, guys, is LeBron James deserving of the MVP, even if the Cavs lose, even if the Cavs have lost by the time people are hearing us talk about this?
I think if you look at the numbers and if you look at his performance just in a vacuum, yeah, it's kind of a no-brainer. He's been the most dominant, most, you know, outstanding. No matter how, what kind of analogy you want to make or what kind of word you want to use for how he's played, he's been the best. Now then you get into the question of parsing the word value, and that's something that has tripped up many a sports
writer. And we talked about it when we talked about Harden versus Curry a month ago, or two ago.
And is it possible to be most valuable even in a series that your team has lost? Especially, you were talking about this earlier, Kate, before the show. If they lose tonight, they'll have not, they've only won 2 games in the series. It's not like they pushed it to 7. So the question becomes, can you truly be the most valuable in that kind of a series? And it's a really tough question, I think. I don't have any answers.
I find it hard to give him that MVP if they do lose, if they have lost or they do lose game 6 because of that. Because it's like, all right, if this Herculean effort and you've dragged this team so far, and that's absolutely true, but then if you're only winning 2 games in the finals, how can that truly be, you know, the most valuable performance when you've got obviously a winning team on the other end? But so, of course, I reserve kind of like the right to watch tonight's game and figure out what Steph Curry does, what Iguodala does, because there are certainly people even outside of Philadelphia calling for him to possibly be the MVP of the series. But I do feel like, assuming LeBron plays the quality we've seen him play, that in a way, you kind of have to honor him with this MVP, because what is that for if it's not to signal like absolutely revolutionary performances?
And interestingly, we didn't get a chance to talk about Duncan Keith, my favorite country star and NHL player, who won the Conn Smythe in the Stanley Cup Finals, partly because he played something like 30 minutes
a
game as a defenseman on the ice. So I do think a little – I wonder if a little bit – advanced stats have changed the conversation around endurance in sports a little bit, because we see that LeBron's workload, and Neil, I think this was in a piece that you wrote, LeBron's minutes per game and usage rate in those minutes that he's playing is more of a stretch than almost any other player in NBA Finals history. And you're almost, as you guys said, you sort of have to give it to him, partly because he's been this integral, this present, and this good, and that threesome, when faced with a Warriors team that hasn't had a standout performance, really sets LeBron apart. And I wonder if endurance is becoming more valued as sports gets more analytics-y, or is that just a crazy theory I've come up with?
Well,
while
I think
sitting here,
even in reading the Tom Haberstroh piece about that, that doesn't even always look at his usage rate on the court, but it's also looking from a sports science perspective.
And that piece was about the enormous amount of stress, mm-hmm. and that his body is going and psyche is going through by playing this much, right?
Well, I think in the case of LeBron, reading Tom Haberstroh's piece about not just LeBron's usage rate on the court, but also the amount of toll is being taken on his body just by his usage rate in the NBA, and even like the sports science behind that, and the hydration and the minutes and all that toll on his body. The travel too is really, really interesting in that, in terms of cross country flights. But I think in this day and age, you have to take into account LeBron's endurance and over the years his ability to stay healthy, and then also in these playoffs his usage rate, because I think we're seeing an athlete in a performance that just defies all odds, which I think, even though you want to lean toward, we'll give it to a member of the winning team, even if the performance wasn't even that inspired, you have to at some point in sport look at like what is changing the game, who is doing things that are completely different than anybody else? What's inspiring sports to like move along? And the things in LeBron's career, and now we're seeing it sort of in a microcosm in the last couple of weeks, he's doing things in at a usage rate and in a sport and with the number of games played and the travel that is just unfathomable. I think that's the word they use, unfathomable. Within the Tom Haberstroh piece, even said that's what people were saying about his performance this year.
And I think that might be the key to why he would eventually get it this year, is that unlike in other years where you had performances that, you know, came on the losing team and you could have made a case, I think in this particular situation, we can all just, we can't even relate to what LeBron is going through, but we can recognize it and kind of commiserate with him and sort of understand that he is truly carrying a team all by himself, practically.
And our colleague Benjamin Morris wrote something where he calculated that the percentage of points, rebounds, and assists that a player has had in the finals for all players on the entire floor. So theoretically, if every player was evenly distributed and the scores were tied each time, I guess it would be 10% for players. LeBron has 19% of all the points scored in the finals, 13.5% of the rebounds, and 23% of every assist in the finals. And that to me is why the MVP case is pretty open and shut. Now, one thing we talked about last week was whether or not the Cavs defense had somehow discovered a fatal flaw in the Warriors, and we talked about whether three-pointers were more hot and cold than maybe other strategies. And interestingly, the Warriors have recovered in their defense, perhaps because the Cavs got tired, perhaps because they've gone small. And I wanted to ask you guys what you sort of how lineup changes work in a sort of game theory way, which is that when the Warriors got small, the Cavs got super small, and LeBron was playing the center, and I think, I forget if it was Jeff Van Gundy or someone on ABC's telecast was talking about Magic Johnson playing the center during a game in the 80s in the finals. And in my mind, you know, you can match small ball for small ball, but then shouldn't that mean that a team's also open to be exploited by you bring in Mozgov, let's say, and he should just be able to dunk over everybody? Like, I don't quite get how that all works.
Well, I'm with you, because I think the way I look at it is if Golden State goes small and then Cleveland responds by going small, that's a very safe route, it feels like to me. Because if you go big there, you're taking a risk that now you're going to give up threes by Golden State, or, you know, they're going to be faster than you, they're going to push it in transition. But also, if you just match them, it's kind of like you're obviously letting them set the pace. You're letting them dictate the game. And if I'm the Cavs, I can't just match them. I can't do what's safe at this time. It feels to me like the Cavs need to try and exploit something. They're kind of in that position.
And is that especially because Mozgov has been good when he's been on the court this finals? Or you're saying
general? Yeah, I mean, I think it specifically for the Cavs now, because of what we've seen from the way the Cavs have won those games when they're going bigger instead of matching the small, it makes sense for the Cavs. And also, if you're just looking at it from an abstract risk-reward place and where the Cavs need to take some chances, if you look at it from that philosophical standpoint as well.
Yeah, that's the underdog always has to take more chances. I feel like if you go small to match Golden State's smallness, you're sort of playing right into Golden State's hands. And that was what was so interesting at the point in the series when Steve Kerr actually did go with his smaller lineup. The people were saying, well, Cleveland is just going to batter them even harder on the boards, because that had been a theme of the early stage of the series. And they would do that presumably with their big lineup, but instead, you know, they kind of responded to that change in kind with their personnel and sort of took away what had been the strength that was correlated with them doing so well early in the series. But I also am inclined to sort of, you know, chalk things like this up to, I think we had a conversation in a show about a month ago about baseball and about players who are in slumps and being able to quantify that. I think in basketball, you can also go through slumps, particularly it's looking like the Warriors early in the series was sort of a shooting slump. And your tendency in a slump is to change something because you feel like you, whatever you're doing right now isn't working and you need to make a change. But it could just be that we're chalking up to one of these changes, something that would have happened anyway, and that the Warriors were actually just due to shoot better, basically. And that kind of is the story of the series, is that they had some down games. Now they're not having down games, and you can make all the coaching adjustments or what have you. At the end of the day, they just ended up playing more like they had played for the previous 100 games, like you said, Chad.
Okay, let's leave it there. Neil had to duck out, but we've replaced him with Allison McCann, who brings us our significant digit every week. Allison, what have you brought this week?
I've got another Women's World Cup.
Yes,
digit.
Great.
Significant Digits is now just turned into weekly Women's World Cup update for as long as I
I'm
can
into it.
Control yeah. this. So I've got 6%, which was the chance that Colombia had to beat France on Saturday in the second game of their group stage. And they went on to win 2-0. It was the second Oof. Biggest upset in Women's World Cup history. The only bigger upset was Brazil's 1-0 victory against host nation Sweden in 1995. Mm-hmm. And only 4 upsets in the tournament history have had less than a 10% chance of happening. So this was a pretty huge. A lot of us, myself included, were gunning for France. And Colombia just stuck it out. They packed in the back and pulled out, which was a huge, huge upset in Women's World Cup history.
Was that 6% according to your model?
This was according to our...
If I can ask, if you know, what's France's probability now, a percent chance of winning it all?
I think it went down to, I believe it's 6%.
Oh, wow.
Of winning it all, not
of winning it all.
Stage.
Yeah. No, they're still very likely to advance to the... onto the knockout rounds, but
is Colombia now very likely to advance?
Colombia is also there. They're sitting.
So it's probably going to be Colombia and France that move out of the group.
Yeah, and England's in that group too, and so that's likely to be one of the three team
the
advance groups.
I call them wild card. I heard this theory, and you can probably debunk it for me, that the road out of that group is actually easier if you don't win the group, and therefore France actually just.
Ooh.
Oh, yeah.
Gamesmanship.
Might have just done a little gamesmanship and allowed the biggest upset to happen. What do you think of that? I don't really think it's likely, because would France want to put itself in a position to have to get a result in their third
game? Who do they
avoid?
Do we know who they avoid?
They would have faced Germany in the quarterfinals, and so now they can get around that roadblock. But I do think nobody – it's so crazy what's shaking out in these group stages. Like, the odds of everything are just, like, down to the end, so – well, I don't know if they could have known that going into it, because Germany and Norway had tied. So at that point, you were like, oh, maybe Germany would have gotten second in the group. But anyway, they do now seem to have an easier route. So it might have worked out in their favor. But, you know, they'll have to face.
I actually didn't get a chance to watch that match because I was covering the ones out in Vancouver. What did you see from the Colombia team? Do they look like a legit, not contender maybe to win, but to make more noise going through the tournament?
So I don't know, because this was one of those soccer games that, like, France, they outpossessed to, like, 70% to 30%. They outshot. They outcompleted. They, like, had 5 times as many completed passes. So they were definitely statistically the better team in this, but Colombia did well to just really bunker in. They scored their goals on sort of, like, quick counterattacks, and I think France was just, like, you know, sort of chilling in this game, and I think they were definitely a better team. They should have not played that poorly, and I don't know. I'm excited to see how Colombia does now. They have an awesome player that I was really excited to see do well, Yoreli Rincon, who people have been, you know, excited to have a breakout World Cup.
I'll also add that I got to watch Cameroon in person 2 matches. They're an up and coming nation for sure when it comes to women's soccer, and they had a couple players who I think one plays for Lyon. So already sort of established, but I was really impressed with Cameroon.
Yeah, well, I remember, like, in the past few weeks, we keep being like, is this going to be the World Cup where, like, well, you know, are we closing the gap? Are these sort of, like, notoriously worse teams, like, closing in? And I think this game against France was the first time we're being like, yeah, like, a worse team can beat a better team. So it's not sort of going to always just be these big blowouts.
Right, it's always nice to see that. Like, same with in women's college basketball, when you see an upset, you're just like, see, there can be more excitement. There's all of, like, you know, the favorites winning isn't always the case. And that's always good for the sport.
Totally.
Excellent. Okay, Allison, thanks for coming by, as always. Sit here, actually, because Neil's not here. So you can...
I will. Get comfortable.
I'm going to say what I always say. That'll do it for this week's show. Thanks to Allison McCann for bringing us her significant digit.
Thanks for having me.
And to Kate Fagan, as always.
Thanks, Chad.
So our podcast producer is Jody Avergan. Our video producer is Ryan Nantel. We have production assistance from Jordan Shulkin. Our intern, still with us, has not fled, Asta Chaturvedi. Once again, thanks to SeatGeek for sponsoring the show. Remember to use the promo code TAKEDOWN when buying tickets on the SeatGeek app. You can email us at contact@538.com. We'd love to hear what you think. And, of course, find us on SoundCloud, Stitcher, Downcast, all sorts of other apps. We're also on iTunes. You can subscribe at itunes.com/538. Be sure to review and rate the show while you're there. It helps others discover the program. Our theme song that you are probably listening to right now is by Mystery Mansion. I'm Chadwick Matlin. Talk to you next time.